I'd like to call to order the March 8th meeting of the Senate Education Committee. I believe Senator Olson has a Senate File 1531 in front of us. Senator Olson. Members, I'd like a motion to take Senate File 1531 from the table. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion adopted. Senator Olson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. We've had a couple of sessions on this bill, and I've listened to some of the concerns, and we're trying to get it in a shape that will hopefully have some good support to send off to higher education.
Senator Olson, do you have the A9 amendment? Would you like to offer that?
I do. I would like to offer the A9 amendment.
All those in favor, signify by saying...
Discussion.
So before you adopt it...
We're not that big, I know it's
okay. Yes. I imagine there's some, and this is an important amendment, Senator Tomasoni. You'll be very glad to see the contents of this amendment. Let's have some discussion on that. And Senator Olson, would you like to present that A9 amendment?
Yes. I think the two concerns that were expressed, and I'm not sure I totally agree with them. I think that some accommodation, at least for a start in this direction, for our career and tech potential students that need the turn-on that this can give them, we'll make those changes. And that is, instead of for lowering it to 10th and 11th, or 9th and 10th, to eliminate the 9th grade. Because there was some concern about that age, and that there might be some difficulty in making that adjustment, although there are others that say that is not a problem. We have in your materials, I believe, this time, the post-secondary enrollment options bill language that does lay out what's in current law relative to the counseling and the... I don't know if I got it, have it with me. I probably don't, but the counseling and the decision making on the part of the parents, being sure that it's laid out what the risks and consequences might be of making that decision, and so my feeling is that parents and the family that is involved are clearly capable of making that kind of decision. But I think, especially when we're dealing with the career and tech areas, within our high schools, the predominance of them are at the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade levels. And so if we're trying to encourage that, I think it doesn't hurt to lower that to the 10th grade for taking an exploratory course or a sampling course at a post-secondary institution. And then we had some discussion about what category of colleges and universities would be eligible if a Minsku campus is not willing to accept them for a program. And if you'll notice on page on one line 1.4 and 5, it is instead of just all that is the one category of the statute of 136A. Is a broader, includes a broader list, but when you narrow it further, that is eligible to receive state student aid. And that is a criteria that we have, I believe, now with the regular PSEO, and so we're making this consistent with that. And we've put in a definition on page 1, line 22, what a career and tech course is, to give some clarification there. It's a course that's part of a career and technical education program that provides individuals with coherent, rigorous content aligned with academic standards and relevant technical knowledge and skills needed to prepare for further education and careers in current and emerging professions, and provide technical skill proficiency, an industry-recognized credential, and a certificate, diploma, or an associate degree. So I think that helps clarify what that means. And again, the one line 12 is deleting 9th, And we've taken out the for-profit trade school and inserted college or university.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Members, do you have any questions on the A9 amendment? It sounds like many of the things that we discussed at our last meeting have been addressed in this amendment. Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, I think this is for Senator Olson. I know you've taken out for-profit trade school and inserted college or technical. No, wait, no. College or university, and how does that apply to Section 136A, as opposed to how it applied before?
Senator Olson.
Well, it includes, it's focused on college and universities that also are eligible for the state grants. So we've added another qualifier there.
So, Senator Tomasoni?
Yes.
These are the colleges and universities that our former colleague, Senator Pogemiller, as Commissioner of Higher Ed, oversees. So these are all of those colleges and universities that are eligible for the state grant program, which is overseen by the Office of Higher Education.
So
Does that clarify that for you?
Madam Chair, so there are some privates. Are there for-profits also?
Senator Tomasoni, I can't speak to whether there are for-profits. I can tell you the state grant can be used for privates and state colleges and universities within the state of Minnesota.
I'm just checking on the for-profits and whether or not we're still going out of state with the online courses.
I don't believe so.
No. And we're not doing any for-profits.
No. There's in that grant list, there's none that are approved for online.
Okay.
That I'm aware of.
Members, just a little bit of clarification from research. With the language that is crafted in the A9, there's no out-of-state colleges or universities because those are not eligible for the state grant. However, it is parallel with current qualifications, which would allow for-profit schools, just as the current state grant program does.
So
consistent, I guess, is the key word here.
But, Madam Chair, I don't have the current. If you have the current law in front of you, they have to qualify by a national standard, and there's an organization that proves because they have to be credit granting, and so that when they're going through our post-secondary enrollment options, that's in current law for our current ones, and we expect the same for this.
Madam Chair,
I think that also narrows it.
Just one
Senator Tomasoni.
Final clarification, Madam Chair, and Senator Olson. So if I remember correctly from the last time, 136A included online courses that were offered by out-of-state colleges, and so does this preclude any online courses from out-of-state colleges?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Tomasoni. The list gets narrowed down by being the state grant, and that does not encompass the online courses.
Further discussion. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, what I'd like to zero in on is on 1.8, the phrase that says rigorous content aligned with academic standards. I'm just wondering if how can I explain it? If you go back to the proposal or the bill that you heard in your committee that I had brought, the problem that we encountered was that I think is the word aligned, but I think the problem was we couldn't quite get over the fact that it still required the licensure of those who taught, let's say, courses, whether it be math or science or whatever, to not accept a different program that contained a lot of the math and science or whatever programs being taught to come from any other source than than from that basic licensure.
Well, if that is happening, we may need to examine this further. This is has to do with the post-secondary courses and the credit granting and the transferability, because we're going with dual credit, that they would get credit at the high school level as well as the college level. I know that there's a challenge with this because the they may meet the standards for the things that is needed, are needed in this career area. They may not fit the mold of the way we structure the courses, whether it's at the secondary and even sometimes in the straight academic post-secondary area. And it's not my intent that we're going to force them into that mold, because maybe this is the proper place to interject. Another piece of paper that I think you have there is what that reinforces not only both Senator Stumpf and I were rejoicing when we saw this, because it supports our longstanding, more than a hunch, it's a conviction that the absence of opportunity in our career and technical area in our secondary schools is contributed to the dropout rate. And if you look at the piece of paper that says Carl Perkins Core Indicator, it turns out that young people who have taken even 1 year, you know, an hour a day, you know, two semesters, 1 hour a day, 200 hours, have their statewide four-year graduation rates of students that have taken that much within the career tech area, our graduation rate is 97.12%. It's twice the graduation rate of the Minneapolis schools. Don't mean to pick on, but that's 48%, 48.6. So, you know, our belief that the diminishing of those kinds of opportunities for our young people has definitely contributed to the lower graduation rate. And it's an area that we need to focus on. And that's the purpose of both what Senator Stumpf has been trying to do, and we've been working on that bill, and there's some fiscal stuff that we're waiting for that hopefully we can advance that as well. But this bill is focused on that as well, because some of our schools now don't have the capacity. If they've cut out some of these programs, don't have the capacity for doing it, for offering these programs, or they may, if there's an opportunity through a post-secondary school to be able to have that fire lit and get started, maybe we'll have some more interest as our schools are being pressured to increase their graduation rate of finding ways to reestablish some balance in the program areas, so that the young people can be afforded this opportunity as well.
Senator Stumpf, just follow up.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, this wasn't really my statement. Wasn't so much a question as something to watch as it goes through, as you move forward, and because I think it was not only the programs that weren't available, but also the limiting factor of how we've addressed licensure, and mm-hmm. and so I think we need to look at a number of those things that would open up the pathway for mm-hmm. for young people.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
And Senator Stumpf, at the post-secondary level, they don't have licensure, and yet we're allowing credits taken at the post-secondary level to count. So hopefully we negate some of that at that level. But you're absolutely right. And I may not be around here to be vigilant, but I hope that there will be any number of you that will pick up the charge, who are good, you know, who will be back, that will work to that end, so that we can restore both some balance and some opportunity for the young people that I think learn in different ways, and for whom there are some great opportunities out there if we get our act together.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Senator Torres, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, I just wanted to say thank you for doing this. I've been thinking, and as you know, I have some amendments that I wanted to put together that really address this. And so I thank you for listening to us and listening to the people who had some concerns about mm-hmm. this language, and I feel much better after this has been sure. addressed. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Torres Ray, and this will go on to higher education, so there will be further opportunity to discuss it in that context as well.
Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. In that spirit, I'd also like to thank Senator Olson for the additional improvements to hopefully get this a true consensus bill. And I think the higher ed review will help further reflect on some of the questions posed on those options. There are two things. I think you also would want your amendment to include page 4, line 16. On the A4 amendment that we had passed, that was yours, line 1.8 on the A4, there's a reference to ninth grade on the mm-hmm. appropriation adjustment.
Okay.
I could ask.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Wieger, I think you're amending the A4 amendment. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes. But
what we'd like to do, Senator Wieger, is for the moment, mm-hmm. hang on to your thoughts, address the A9 amendment, get that adopted as the committee sees fit, and then we'll address the bill as amended, because that A4 amendment has already been amended onto the bill.
Okay.
All right. So, members, is there any more discussion on the A9 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A9 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Amendment adopted. Senator Wieger, now I think you might want
yes.
to be addressing the
yes.
A4.
The A4, Madam Chair, and Senator Olson, at line 1.8, would move to delete ninth and, so that this only applies to 10th grade.
It's consistent.
Senator Olson?
Thank you. Thank you yes? for catching that.
All right. Members, any questions on that? Okay. All in favor of Senator Wieger's oral amendment, that would be line 1.8, deleting the word ninth and. Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Amendment adopted. Senator Wieger.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I did have a chance to talk to, I believe, Mr. Nathan and a few others, and you've done a very good job in communicating this to others involved in the amendments we've adopted. But one other item I had was, should there be some threshold for the 10th grader and 9th grader, but now 10th grader. And this amendment, the A10, before I introduce it, I want to ask Senator Olson for reaction. It basically, it's one sentence that says, if a 10th grade pupil applying for this would have to have a passing score on the 8th grade Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment. And so that if you have a 9th grader that's in college, it says you'd be proficient in reading at the 8th grade level. I believe that's a test score of 75 at the department level.
Senator Olson, do you have that amendment yet?
I do.
Okay, and comments?
Well, you know where I stand on reading.
I do. I do.
I don't, and Mr. Nathan has taken a look at this as well. I don't see any problem with putting that there. I wouldn't like to see overload with requirements. And if it turned out to be a barrier that was keeping people from, because it's not allowed for remedial classes at the collegiate level. We haven't done that with our post-secondary enrollment options, and that's not the intent here either. So this would at least be an indicator of that. So I would accept that.
Members, is there any more discussion on the A10? Okay. Senator Wieger moves the A10 amendment. Seeing no further discussion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Amendment adopted. Senator Olson, to your bill as amended.
Well, Madam Chair, there are a couple of people here that have come today that would like to just give a very short word as to the yes. significance and meaning of this proposal to their
yes,
their
if they could come to the table, and while they're doing so, I might call on Senator Bonoff. Did you have a question, Senator Bonoff, or comment?
And I
Madam Chair, I'll pass.
Okay, thank you.
And I believe Senator Torres Ray has
There will be another testifier as well. Senator Olson, let's see, we have Teddy Gray Owl. If you could introduce yourself for the committee, please. Welcome to the committee.
Teddy Gray Owl. Would you like me to start?
Yes, please.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for letting me have this opportunity to testify before you on the support for the post-secondary enrollment opportunities for high school students. I'm Teddy Grail, and I have 25 years' experience of working with American Indian students in Minneapolis. I'm here to support allowing 9th and 10th grade students to try a PSEO course and to allow any 11th or 12th grade students to try one course to see if he or she is ready. While high school provides a rigor and foundation in preparing students for college, college coursework can take students beyond the standards into critical thinking, analysis, and interpretation. Many high school students have demonstrated they are prepared for college by successfully completing PSEO courses and getting a head start in their college education. The 1985 adoption of PSEO has afforded poor and low-income students to earn college credits and to pave an achievable path to college. However, American Indian students are underrepresented in PSEO programs because many can't meet the criteria for eligibility, even though many can succeed, even with hands-on technical and career courses. Within the past 2 months, another teacher and I have worked with 18 American Indian students from South High School and Hawaii Center School to participate in two local science fairs. 7 have advanced to National American Indian Science Fair in Albuquerque, 5 had advanced to the Minnesota State Science Fair, and 2 have won opportunities to submit research papers to a national science fair as well. While American Indian students tend to learn through hands-on and visual environments and less by the lecture-based classroom, they have demonstrated their capacity to excel in the competitions where they are required to complete research, testing, data analysis, and present and discuss their work. These successes have led to accomplishments in the other courses at school and, importantly, to their desire to go on to college. Barriers should not be added to hinder a student's path to higher education. We tell students that they need to go to college because more complex work environments require more complex training. They will need to know how to interpret data, research, and analyze and present their work, all key in helping students become leaders, innovators, and even policymakers. I urge the committee to allow 9th and 10th graders to try a PSEO career tech class and to give all 11th and 12th graders a chance to try a class, even if they do not meet traditional criteria to earn dual credit, and to relax criteria and not to add barriers so that many more students have a chance to take advantage of educational options that are accessible. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee, any questions for Teddy Grayow? Thank you very much.
And I have worked with students on getting them to college courses through PSEO, and I've seen it really make them successful and to really want to go to college and continue their careers in education.
Thank you for your testimony and the voice of experience. I appreciate that. And our next testifier is Tony Simmons. Simmons, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself for the tape, please.
My name is Tony Simmons, and I'm the program director at the High School for Recording Arts, an independent public charter school in St. Paul. We've been around since 1998, and I've also been asked to speak on behalf of the African American Leadership Forum. Much of what I have to say really mimics my colleague, and so I'm not going to get into some of the details that she did, except to say that in my last 13, 14 years in working at an urban charter school in St. Paul, where 80% of our students are African American, 60% are male, over 90% free and reduced lunch, I know the challenges of creating a college-going culture with my students and with their families. PSEO has made a tremendous difference in helping us create a college-going culture. When we discuss the options to the students and their parents, when we let them know how they can literally save thousands of dollars by taking advantage of these options, and that they can get a real head start towards being college ready and being able to go on and finish college and having a successful career and life, it really makes a difference. I think extending it to 9th and 10th graders really just makes that job even easier for us. It's hard enough when you're dealing with families where that is not really their background in terms of college. It's very intimidating to them. But having their children have an opportunity with the support of the school that they've chosen to really back them up and give them that support really makes a difference. So I just urge the committee to allow for there to be no barriers with respect to 9th and 10th graders and for us to fully embrace PSEO.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons. And just for clarification, the amendments we adopted now will limit this to 10th graders. So we're not adding 9th graders today. Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just going to ask our testifiers, since we did reduce it, to undo some angst on the part of members as to whether 9th grade was appropriate. Do you want to make a further defense as to whether you think that our angst is misplaced of allowing 9th graders in there, or either one of you? I think it wouldn't hurt for us to hear what
Mr. Simmons, Ms. Grayal, would you like to address Senator Olson's next bill, which is 9th grade?
Well, I work with 9th through 12th graders. And
yes,
and
Ms. Grayal.
I don't think the grade level is the determining factor. It's the student's capability. I am amazed at some students who come into high school ready to take Algebra 2. They have done Algebra, they have done Geometry in middle school, and they're ready for Algebra 2. Some students are not quite there. So I don't think grade level should be the determining factor whether a student is ready or not. It just amazes me when you get the student in the right environment, what makes them excel, such as doing the science fair projects that we do. And I'm sure with your production work as well, too.
Yeah, I agree.
Mr. Simmons.
Yes, I agree with what you say. My way of looking at it is I have a 2.5-year-old. I like to think I'm getting her ready for college now. And and the way she's progressing, I'm not sure, maybe by 6th, 7th, 8th grade, she'll be ready for college. I think in families like mine that, have a college-going background, we understand that. I think for the families that we're talking about where that's not the case, starting to have that conversation earlier is really just makes sense. Like my colleague said, we're able to determine if that young person is ready or not, but there really shouldn't be any artificial barrier to that. We really should be trying to have those conversations as early as the educators see fit and the family see fit.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons. Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, and Senator Olson, are you sure that you needed to get rid of 9th grade? It sounds like perhaps the conversation around the table might be... Oh, you're. I'm sorry.
So. Senator DeCryf.
On that point.
Yes.
Yeah. On that point. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm the one that talked about I would like to eliminate the 9th graders from this, and here's my reasoning. I might be a little old fashioned here, but I'm the guy that didn't let my daughter date until she's 16. And I think that there's a certain maturity level where kids are ready to step up into that next level. And I'm not sure 9th grade is there. An extra year, I think, makes a lot of difference. And I would hate to see us open the door up to some very well-adjusted kids where a parent, I know a parent would make this decision, but I know parents that of my daughter's friends who didn't give them a curfew. And my daughter came home and said, well, my friends don't have a curfew. Why should I? And I'm thinking that some parents don't make great decisions. So I'm hoping that that extra year gives these kids a successful experience as opposed to something that might be less than successful. So I'm a little concerned about that one extra year of maturity that we opened up a door that may be something that is adversarial to some younger children.
Does anyone else have any comments today? Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, and Senator DeCryf, we agree again. It's unbelievable. but I think that we should go slow here because I maybe the idea of 9th graders going is a good one, but I also am concerned about moving them from the 9th grade to the college set because I think that's a huge step. And while academically they may be able to do it, it's a whole different thing to talk about the social atmosphere and what kind of pressures there are there. So I agree with eliminating 9th grade here just because I think it's it might be a step-by-step thing that we should be taking here as opposed to jumping in with both.
Members, are there any other questions, comments? Senator Sieben?
Well, Madam Chair, not for the testifiers, but for Senator Olson.
Okay. We have one more testifier, and maybe you want to hear the testimony first and then save your comments just in case they might be answered. Senator Torres-Ray has a testifier here, Susan Henderson from the University of Minnesota. Ms. Henderson?
Thank you so much. They will come. Did you get a chance to sign up?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Yes. I'm Susan Henderson. I'm Director of PSEO and College in the Schools at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities Campus. I want to start out with just a request for clarification. I don't have all the amendments, but what I printed out today, under subdivision 5, that is the first place that the grades of students is specified, and I know now that ninth grader is no longer there. But my question is, it seems to me that where this is placed, it applies not just to the career and technical education, but to all students seeking to do PSEO. Is that correct?
I'll have our council address that.
Did limit that.
Madam Chair, members, I think she might be looking at an older version.
It's an older version.
I think the bill is introduced because the subdivision 5A is only for career and tech.
Madam Chair, I think our intent was not to open up, but rather with the notion that we've been talking about as allowing for one course to explore in that career and tech area that might ignite the fire and get them going down a path that will enable them to either finish high school or continue on in one of the programs at the college level. And so that it does not, I think our early amendment did correct that so that it doesn't automatically apply, in particular in terms of changing those entrance requirements. It was allowing, if they were doing well, you know, that's not the issue. The issue is some of these kids are underperforming in the current current structure, and this can give them a taste of something that's real in how those that learning, academic learning, and others is applied, and therefore hopefully light that fire. And I think the people that have been at the firing lines that have been testifying have demonstrated that time and again, both students, teachers, and others, that it can have that effect. And that's why this is an option that through guidance from families as well as within the school that can help to do that.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Ms. Henderson, has your question been adequately answered?
So am I correct now in understanding that in general, PSEO is open to 11th and 12th graders. However, for the career and technical education, it's open to 10th graders as well.
Yes.
For one course.
Then I'm done.
Thank you very much for getting some clarification on that. Now, members, is there any? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just to point out, Senator Olson, how good you are. You know, that now the people who had all of these questions are really pleased with the changes. I had a couple of amendments, as you know, but these amendments are really in line with the work that you did to correct this bill. And I had one amendment that I wanted to bring forward after my conversation with Mrs. Hendrickson and others around really how little we know about, you know, how many kids are applying for these opportunities and how we need to bring that conversation back to the legislature. And in trying to respond to that, I was hoping that we could adopt some language. I have the A7 amendment, Senator Olson, that simply states that we will ask for a report of the children that are enrolled in these post-secondary courses. So the intent for now is simply to obtain the information so that we can come back to review and hopefully, you know, in future years as we expand these opportunities, figure out, you know, who are the children? Are we getting more 10th and 11th graders, you know, getting into technical careers, or what are some of the options that kids are pursuing so that we can really talk about funding? Because that's one of my my hesitations again and again, you know, that these are great ideas and we need to sit down and figure out how do we fund this? How do we increase the funding for the districts?
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair and Senator Torres Gray. So my question was, who's responsible for that? The district? Mr. Nathan, why don't you come join me too?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Olson. Correct. So the idea would be that the district simply say, you know, these many children have requested information, or, you know, we can work. I didn't want to be so prescriptive on the language as to, you know, what do we report, but we can work on trying to figure out, you know, what are some of the what is some of the specific information that we need to get in order to really understand how these options are being utilized by the districts, the kids that are attending, and then what do we do? How do we maximize, you know, the resources that we have, or increase the resources for certain opportunities?
Senator Olson?
Nobody has followed this, the issue of post-secondary enrollment options, more than this gentleman who is sitting next to me, Joe Nathan. So I'm going to ask him. I'm just slightly reluctant to add more mandates or requirements of reporting. We've been trying to lift some of that, but I just want to see if there's do we know this now? What is the source of information that helps with future policy in this?
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Mr. Nathan, you might.
Dr. Nathan, welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the question and the opportunity to comment. One of the central hallmarks of good policy is that you base it on data and research, and the research and the data don't always agree. Studies might conflict. But I completely agree that it's important to have high-quality data to help guide decision-making. In the case of the post-secondary enrollment options, the colleges and universities do report to the State Department of Education on the number of students who are participating. This is true. It is broken down by city, by school district, by institution. You can get a computer run right now that shows exactly how many students are participating in PSEO at the University of Minnesota in the 11th grade, at the University of Minnesota in the 12th grade, at Minnesota State Mankato in the 11th grade, and so on and so forth. So right now, the current data reporting system is such that you can obtain information that shows precisely how many students throughout the state at every grade level, at every institution. So I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly want to respect the desire of the senator to have high-quality information. There are a considerable number of computer runs that are currently available that will show you precisely how many students in precisely which grade and precisely which institution, and that information is currently being gathered by the Minnesota Department of Education under current requirements.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nathan, so do you feel that, you know, my intent was to kind of bring that to the schools, but is it your feeling that with that information we will have sufficient guidance? My intent here is simply to have a pretty good picture of what is going on so that we can continue to talk about the need for funding. So the kind of getting the picture from the schools early on about those that intend to enroll, is it enough, you think, for now to have just the ones that are enrolled that are really reported by the higher education institutions, because there is a difference between the two. But, you know, I could be persuaded either way. I just want to have the information, I guess.
Dr. Nathan.
Madam Chair, members, and Senator, the concern I have is about the word intend, because youngsters may intend and not actually enroll. And I want to put, as I know you do, I want to put every possible dollar into the actual instruction of young people and the improvement of education. And the more time that we put into asking people to do reports, and the more time we have people doing reports, the less time they have to work with the youngsters. So I think it's highly appropriate to ask the Department of Education to supply the legislature with information yearly about how many students are participating. Moreover, demographic information is available. You probably saw that our recent report that so demographic information is available. So it isn't just a matter of how many youngsters. It's a matter of how many male and female and how many African-American and so on and so forth. So if your intent is to gather information about who's participating, I think that that's currently available. Moreover, I know that your desire is to see every possible dollar devoted to the improvement instruction. So I would urge caution in terms of asking for more information gathering at the high school level.
Senator Torres, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that testimony. I would like to withdraw the amendment. I think that it's clear that we do have the information, and you know, we have to work with what we have for now. So I would like to withdraw my amendment.
The A7 has been withdrawn. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson and maybe Dr. Nathan has comments on this. Could you talk more about on lines 416 why you're removing the solicitation or advertising? Because it seems to me that, well, I just wanted to hear more of your thoughts on that.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, they can advertise now. It just says that they can't make any statements as to whether on the financial grounds. In other words, that they can't make the claim that if they take these courses, what it might save them ultimately in terms of college tuition and in completing their college education. And some of them are making their that is a motivation to be able to acquire. And some do get as far as even a two-year degree and can finish their college in 2 years. That is a major saving to the students and to their families. And the colleges are accepting essentially that portion of the secondary student aid that we give as the tuition and the cost that we're not paying more for it. We're not paying at their rates. They are accommodating that. So if they are, you know, I don't know how many would advertise toward that end or not, but it just takes that barrier out that they can't indicate what the savings might be. It's not reducing or taking out advertising totally. They can do that now.
Members, any further comments? Dr. Nathan, do you have something to add?
Madam Chair and Senators, I'll be very brief. We call this the truth in advertising phrase because currently public high schools throughout the state can and do point out to families that they can literally save thousands of dollars, even tens of thousands of dollars, by participating in advanced placement, international baccalaureate, and college in the schools programs. And that's great. As the legislature is challenged, as families are challenged with college costs, we think it's highly appropriate for families to consider the importance of pushing their youngsters to take challenging courses in high school, whether they're college in the schools, advanced placement, or international baccalaureate. This just equates what the high schools can currently do this. The high schools can say, and they do in many cases. We're working with several of them, and we have praised them. High schools are in many cases pointing out to families that there is a huge economic advantage as well as there's a huge economic advantage to challenging yourself. Moreover, as you know, 38% of the youngsters who graduate from Minnesota Public Schools, according to a University of Minnesota and Minnesota State College University System report, 38% of the youngsters who graduate from our public high schools in Minnesota and then enter a Minnesota Public College or University have to take remedial courses. So another reason to do this kind of thing is to encourage more youngsters to take challenging courses so they don't enter our public institution and require and need to take a remedial course. So the idea is on both sides, take these courses so you can save yourself dollars in terms of 4-credit courses, but also take these courses so you don't have to take remedial courses. And more than 50% of the youngsters who are entering our two-year colleges have to take remedial courses. More than 50% have to take remedial courses when they're entering our two-year public colleges and universities in this state. So the idea is to remind youngsters through the good offices of the school districts, but also through the good offices of the colleges and universities.
Thank you, Dr. Nathan. Members, Seeing no more questions, Senator Olson renews her motion that Senate File 15. Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I'm just reading the underneath that, page 2.11 of Subdivision 12 credits. Just give me the rationale for why the language was struck on the credits part.
Senator Tomasoni, what was that question again? Where?
Subdivision 12 under Section 3. There's a stricken language regarding the credits, and I'm just not sure why that language was struck.
Madam Senator Chair Olson. And Senator Tomasoni, it is taking away the limitation that they have to choose one or the other. They could get credit in both.
So with this language,
Senator Tomasoni,
they'll be able to have credit. They take the PSU or they get college and college.
I think the college determines whether they have met the requirements to do that. So it isn't just an automatic, but they can, in fact, obtain college credit as well as high school credit. And Dr. Nathan could correct me or amplify or whatever, clarify for Senator Chavasone, if you will.
Dr. Nathan.
Madam Chair, Senators, right now in high schools in this state, students can take advanced placement, international baccalaureate, college in the schools, and Project Lead the Way, all, in many cases, terrific courses, and earn simultaneously high school credit, and then if the college is willing to accept it, college credit. They don't have to choose between taking an AP course or an IB course or a college in the schools course. They don't have to choose between either high school credit or college credit. And this puts the PSEO courses on the same footing as the AP, IB, college in the schools, and Project Lead the Way. It just says it's going to be the same thing. It's not, so it doesn't add anything other than what's already available for AP, IB, college in the schools, and Project Lead the Way.
Madam Chair,
Senator Thomas,
I'm comfortable with that because I never really knew that we had that provision in our law that had to choose. I always thought when you went to post-secondary options, it was for post-secondary credit and it counted at high school also. So
well, Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I will admit that had slipped by me as well, so we have that in common.
Okay. Members, any other comments on Senate File 1531? Senator Olson renews her motion that Senate File 1531, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to higher education. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion passes. Members, before we're adjourned,
may I say thank
Senator
you very
Olson.
Much for all of the work that you've put in and the suggestions you've made, and hopefully we will have some good results down the pike. Thank you.
Members, before we're adjourned, I think we have a little bit of homework to follow up on from one of our previous sessions, which had to do about cooperative facilities grants. And Mr. Nauman, might you have something to address for us?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. This is a follow-on discussion from the Rushford-Peterson and United South Central bills. Members, especially will recall that when we talked about United South Rushford-Peterson, we got into a conversation about why would a school district do this particular approach as opposed to the maximum effort program, as opposed to the traditional debt service equalization program. So we have put together two documents for you. The first document will give you some general parameters for the eligibility. And then we've taken the two districts that have introduced bills and run them through the formulas using a variety of different, using the three options available. So Mr. Hranica is handing out the first document. And as soon as he's done, I'm going to ask him to talk through that document. What's the purpose and use of debt service, maximum effort, cooperative facilities, then the eligibility requirements and some stipulations. And then while he's doing that, I'm going to hand out the other document that we'll spend most of the time on so that you can see how the dollars flow through these programs. And then maybe that'll facilitate a discussion for all of you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Hranica.
Thank you very much.
So the document that you have in front of you, it, as Eric indicated, it outlines the three programs that we've discussed, the debt service equalization program, the maximum effort capital loan program, and the cooperative facilities grant program. And in this document, I attempted to outline the purpose and use of each of these programs to the extent possible that it aligned with statutory requirements or purposes, the eligibility requirements to the extent that they aligned with the statutory requirements, and any other stipulations that were outlined in statute. First and foremost, I think it's important to indicate that the debt service equalization program is the primary finance vehicle used for districts to purchase or construct new buildings. This is revenue that is a blend of aid and levy, and there are some numbers as to how that breaks down in the document between aid and levy. This was drafted before the forecast, so there probably is some adjustment in those numbers. The eligibility requirements for debt service equalization aid, the local project is subject to review and comment by MD Commissioner, as are all of these programs. When calculating the local debt service, they are to assume that the project is on a 20-year payment schedule, and the aid only applies to K through 12 facilities. The aid payments are equalized according to a debt and a net tax capacity ratio, and that percentage indicated below is then the equalization aid is distributed according to those tiers. So if the percentage of adjusted net tax capacity for debt services below 15.74%, they don't receive any aid. If it's between 15.74 and 26.24%, they receive aid at a lower rate than the second tier, which is between 26.24 and the maximum effort. The second program, Maximum Effort Capital Loan Program, as the purpose and use indicates in statute, is to relieve the districts where the maximum effort by the district is inadequate to provide necessary money. Now, that is language directly from statute. Calculating the eligibility requirements for this, a district is only eligible for Maximum Effort Capital Loan if they... the estimated net debt tax rate is greater than or equal to 41.98%, and that's after the debt service equalization aid is subtracted out. The loan amount cannot exceed either 637% of adjusted net tax capacity or 15% of the total market value of that's taxable total market value. Maximum effort that districts are expected to meet is 33.59% of adjusted net tax capacity. In order to qualify for a maximum effort loan, a law must be passed by this body. The districts have to hold a referendum to approve the levy, and again, the projects are subject to review and comment by the Commissioner of MDE. The third program, Cooperative Facilities Grant, which is our focus, again, I tried to outline the purpose and summarized it to the extent possible that it was reflected in statute. Eligibility requirements are pretty simple, and we discussed these, that those districts eligible are either a consolidated district or any group of districts that were consolidated since 1980. They have to apply to the MDE commissioner, and they qualify after review and comment. Now, new construction loans districts are eligible for new construction loans in the amount of lesser than $20 million or 75% of the approved construction costs. And for the remodeling improvement loans, the cost must not exceed $10 million or 75% of the project costs.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to work through another document with that summary as a background. And as sort of a preface to this, this is the spreadsheet. And there's a lot of numbers on here. We're going to walk through it line by line, hopefully, with your permission. But what I'd like you to first think about this is that most school districts, and I'm going to talk about this in terms of a front-end transaction, a middle-end transaction, and a back-end transaction. And what I mean by that is there's something that may happen on the front end. There may be something that happens in the middle, and that's what most school districts do. And then there's something that may happen for certain districts on the back end. The front end part of this is the cooperative facilities. The debt service equalization is the middle part, and that's what most school districts do to finance their facilities. And then after everything's said and done, on the back end, some districts may be eligible for the maximum effort capital loan. So if you take a look at this document, ignore the cooperative facilities for the first part of this discussion. Options one and two are the combination of debt service and maximum effort. So up at the top, we're showing the total value of the new building. And we just picked the bills that have been introduced. Both have a project cost of about $28.9 million and $28.8 million, respectively. And we did some rudimentary math to determine what a debt service payment would be, and that's what you see on line F. So you take the total value, turn it into a debt service payment over 20 years of about $2.3 million each year. Then you begin by dropping it into the debt service equalization program. And the first thing that's useful to know, you see that debt revenue is the total amount of the payment. For Rushford Peterson, that's 53.4% tax rate, and for United South Central, it's a 23.9% tax rate. So based on the tax base of the districts, there is a difference already between how much they would have to tax themselves relative to the size of their tax base. Then we drop in the pupils, because debt service equalization depends on the amount of tax base per kid. And that's line I. Then the total tax base expressed as an ANTC. ANTC is what we use here in debt service equalization. The two district tax bases. And then we can turn that into a tax base per pupil. And that is line K. In law, we have lines L and M, two equalizing factors. You won't find these two numbers in law. They're there, but these are the updated numbers. Last year, as part of some of the tax bill changes, we adjusted the equalizing factors and threshold rates. With some broad authority, we didn't go in and strike the lines. But what we did was tell the department to recompute them. These are the accurate numbers that we're using here. So the new equalizing factors for Tier 1 is 3049, and the new Tier 2 equalizing factor is 7622. Under law, the first 15.74%, also an updated number, of any debt service, any amount of that 2.3, has to be paid for locally. All school districts have to do that. Then, if there's any amount left over, you begin applying the equalizing factors. So that's what. So the first line N is the first 15.74%, and you can see that in option one, which is what we're working through, both districts meet that, and then there's an amount left over. So then you apply the equalizing factor in Tier 1. We're now down at line Q, $465,000 in the case of Rushford Peterson, and a little over $1 million falls into that first tier. And in the case of both, they don't get any state aid off of the first tier equalizing factor because their tax base per pupil exceeds the amount of the equalizing factor. So there's no aid that accrues to the district, either district in that case. Then you move down to line X, and there is some remaining revenue. Sorry, if you flip over to the second. Sorry, I apologize. I'm getting ahead of myself here. Line S. We move into the second tier, and there is also no state aid that accrues to both districts because in both cases they exceed the... Madam Chair, I apologize. It has been 3 weeks since we prepared this document. And I'm still kind of losing my place a little bit. In the second tier is displayed on line AA and AB. And in the case of United South Central, the school district does not receive any state aid because their amount per tax base per kid exceeds the second tier as well. But in the case of Rushford Peterson, they do get a little bit of state aid. You can see that the percentage of levy on the second tier is 22.5%, and the aid percent is 77.5%. And so then you finally work your way all the way down of these calculations on line AC and AD, and you can see that for United South Central, there is no state aid whatsoever. It's all levy. So the amount up at the top equals the amount up at the bottom, and it's all levy. In the case of Rushford Peterson, they get a little bit of state aid. There's about $270,000 of state aid that accrues to the district as a result of this hypothetical calculation. Then if you look at line AE, the total tax rate after equalization. This is the calculation that determines your eligibility into the maximum effort program. If you're above that 41.98%, you're in. You're technically eligible. So you can see that in the case of United South Central, 23.9 is not eligible, whereas Rushford Peterson was 47.3%. They meet the test, and they can technically be in. Now, once you get in, you still have to determine how much are they eligible for. Members, do you recall the conversation when they were first here, and they said, we're eligible for $2 million? And we all looked around and said, I don't see that number anywhere in statute. And that's true. The number is not anywhere in statute. It's the result of the subsequent calculations. I was confused by the $2 million initially because it seemed a little high to me, and that's because the district wasn't using the updated equalizing factors and threshold rates. Once you update for it, you end up with $771,000 that they would potentially be eligible for. So this is the back-end transaction. So after you do the debt service equalization calculation and you get a rate, how much? Then you determine how much are they eligible for under maximum effort. And you start with their total estimated market value. That's that $496 million. You take their adjusted net tax capacity and perform those calculations in law. Senator Hand said to me, is that really 637% of ANTC? And the answer is yes. That's what the law says. So you calculate the greater of the lesser of those two calculations generates $28.2 million, and the total principal of the project again was 28.9. So the difference between those two numbers generates the eligibility under maximum effort. So if you've got a really small tax base, that number is going to be much bigger, and there's a lot more eligible dollars. So that's why the district is saying maximum effort doesn't do much for us because it's only $771,000. Their example was $2 million, but once you update, it leaves you with $771,000.
Senator Hand?
Just, Mr. Nauman, thank you for that. I just was curious, the 637% adjustment on line AJ, why not 635%? I'm a little confused about that. Why, what drives that number? That seems
this takes
like an
you,
odd number.
It's an, indeed, Madam Chair and Senator Hand, like anything else, these numbers tend to evolve a little bit over time. The history of this number, the most immediate history of this number is, if you look in the statute, it'll tell you 607. Okay. But because of last year's tax bill where they changed the size of the tax base and we told the department to recompute all the equalizing factors and threshold rates, you update this number now to 637 because on the average, that's the math.
Okay.
And my suspicion is that even 607 was a calculated number. because whenever you change the tax base, in order to remain revenue neutral, you've got to adjust these numbers. So it probably started off, I mean, we could do the history on it, but it probably started off at a much more round number. Fiscal analysts like nice round numbers, but that's how it evolved. So is that portion of the transaction, if not crystal clear, a little bit clearer? Because I'm going to introduce the front-end transaction now.
Members, have you all got this now? I was wondering around the table how many of them would like to trade jobs with.
Yeah, no, thank you.
We were preparing a quiz for Senator Daley and Senator Chamberlain.
So, Madam Chair, if I can then ask you to flip back to the front part of the page, I think it becomes a little bit clearer, at least, and please hear that this is an endorsement, but it may offer an explanation of why they're choosing to go this particular route. Debt service still remains a part of the puzzle for these districts at the end in both options. But now looking at what's listed as option three, you start at the same beginning place with 2.9 for Rushford-Peterson and 2.8 for United South Central. And then you apply the cooperative facility eligibility, which, as Mr. Horanek had spoke about earlier, it's 75% of the facility cost or a cap of $20 million.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr.
Just to
Senator
be clear,
Daley.
Instead of I think you meant 28.9 yeah, instead of 2.9.
Did I say 2.9?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator. I did indeed.
Yeah.
But now I've lost my place.
I'm so confused.
So line B is 75% of that number, the 28.9 and the 28.8. So for both districts, you end up with 21 and change, 21.7 and 21.6, or a cap of $20 million. So in both cases, the cap, and it's the lesser of, the cap is the operative number. Remember the number in the bill? Both cases, it was $20 million.
Yeah.
So then what you end up with on line D is how much is left, 8.9 and 8.8. And that's the amount that the school districts would then use debt service for.
Okay.
So what you're doing with the cooperative facilities is slicing off some money on the front end and saying the state is paying for this. And then they only have to do debt service on a much smaller number, and they have a new facility. So if you drop all those numbers through on the option three, you run those through the formula, you'll see at the end the tax rate is much smaller, and they believe that's something that they can pass. Now, Madam Chair, I think there remains a discussion point for this committee about whether this is something that you want to bite off and recommend. But I'm hoping that at least if you think about it as front-end transaction, middle-end transaction, and then the middle transaction, and then the end transaction, that might help you contextualize around why they might be seeking your assistance on this.
Thank you, Mr. Nauman. And members, we've had, we've heard the cases made that there was obviously a great need in these two districts, and yet there was a concern that this was put in place as a policy, as an incentive to consolidation. And there were a number of schools that did use this, but there was never any end to it. And we're not sure just what the consequences of going down the route of funding two major projects like this would in fact do, whether how many more would keep coming in. So we've been asked to consider the policy of this. And so, we can either make a recommendation to the Capital Committee, or we can be silent. We could, we've got some choices, but this is a tough issue and a growing need around the state that we've tried to address in different ways through our capital levies, through maintenance kind of needs. But when a school gets to the point where we saw these facilities, they really need a new facility, and that's where how much more of that we would see. I don't know that we've got any projections of that, what, you know, what could come in the future if we choose that course to fund the bonding or recommend that. Yeah, I don't know if you have any.
Madam Chair, the only thing I would offer here is it's certainly hard to know which ones exactly are going to decide they need a new facility. There was a list of potential eligibility that we handed out the very first time we talked about this. Remember, that was a document from the Department of Education. It had about 5 pages worth of districts that met that test. Literally, they had consolidated between July 1, 1980, and then the test also says another group of districts. So even if you hadn't consolidated, if you're willing to get together, you meet the test. Mm-hmm. So it could be a large number. But that's dependent upon what their facility need is.
Because mm-hmm. in some cases, maybe one of the districts that is involved had a newer facility and was adequate, and they made that kind of adjustment, which is the reason we probably didn't get more of a flood at the time. Senator Stump?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I followed everything or heard everything. Sometimes the mind just kind of shuts off. One additional difference, I think, is that whether it's general fund money or whether it's general obligation bonding money. And the general obligation bonding money would be under the cooperative facilities grant. The debt service equalization is general fund money.
Madam Chair and Senator Stumpf, I guess I don't have any concerns with what you've said there, but I would offer one particular caveat. Certainly the debt service equalization money is clearly general fund. It comes out of, you know, the regular appropriations that this committee makes, part of the annual biennial budgeting process. If the committee were staring at a huge financial surplus in the general fund, as has been done in the past, you could appropriate cash to the cooperative facilities program, and then it wouldn't have to come out of the bonding bill. Alternatively, as I think what we're talking about here, is that the bonding bill is the mechanism to fund, at least if I'm reading the tea leaves correctly, the bonding bill is the mechanism to which the legislature is contemplating these two bills. So I'm just saying it doesn't have to be. It could be general fund in both cases if there were resources to do it. But right now I think we're looking at bonding bill.
But Senator Stump. Madam Chair and members, I think the competition in the bonding area is horrendous. And so one of the things that's happening is that, and rightly so, we're operating under a statute that is in kind of automatic pilot to pay back the shift in the school funding. And we're also, I think, looking at a lot of facilities across the state that are eroding rather rapidly. And so I think the question, it seems to me, for this committee is how do we address the facilities issue in a much longer kind of term manner? I think the school districts across the state are doing a number of things, from closing down facilities and trying to rid themselves of some of this overhead. So they're, I think, doing the best job they can to try to reduce their overhead, both operating and long-term costs that might incur facilities or that the facilities incur. So, I think it would be wise for this committee to invite the school boards or the school district organizations to into a discussion as to how do they see the answer for facilities needs in the next few years. And maybe the solution is some kind of a hybrid of these programs. Because whatever we do kind of sets a precedent. I mean, if we go the route of the grant facilities grant or the cooperative facilities grant program, the districts, if the districts see that as a way to fund a school district A or school district B, and it looks like it's a viable option for one district, it might look like it's going to be a viable option for 20 districts. And I think what we'd like to do would be to at least have thought out, you know, some solution for a lot of districts or many districts or all districts, actually.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
As the committee wrestles with this question, you have a number of policy levers at your disposal that are on this page. One of them, not dissimilar from the operating referendum, is the equalizing factors. And certainly those have remained relatively static over some number of years. Senator Stump, when you were chair, you thought about this with some degree of regularity. It's always tempting when you have dollars to spend in the committee to provide new revenue. But to the extent that the facilities are a factor that this committee wants to wrestle with and do it in a more structural way, as opposed to finding yourself having to cherry pick one district over another, you could look at the equalizing factors. And if you increase those numbers, you are increasing the state aid and bringing down the property tax at the same time. So as, if you think about it as a teeter-totter, the total revenue is the blend of both state aid and the property tax. So dollars injected in the form of an adjustment on the equalizing factor will bring down the property tax and reduce the rate. And the rate ends up being the factor that certainly Rushford Peterson was saying is, hey, the rate is so high we can't pass. It's too extreme for our district. That's a policy lever the committee could wrestle with.
And I can't help but thinking 20 years from now, what will schools look like and what will they need? You know, you look around our chamber and our, you know, committee tables and look at what's happened to us in terms of the way in which we access information and interact. And that's got to have an impact of some kind in terms of what the facility needs. Will we be, you know, will we be busing people, you know, far and wide to big facilities, or will we be doing something different that we can't even, you know, envision right now? But how do we, you know, so I think our policies can incent one direction or another. I don't know. I just.
Madam Chair, just
Senator Stone.
To inject a little bit of levity, actually, our sports teams might have more impact on our facilities than our academic and student achievement.
They need a field.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Thomas.
And as the pressure builds to make decisions on these kinds of things for small communities that don't have much of a tax base, the pressure builds on the same communities to fix their wastewater treatment plants, to fix their streets, and so pretty soon the dollar gets really, really skinny, and pressure on us to come up with some creative solutions to be able to fund a lot of these things is becoming more and more difficult as we run into budgets that are becoming more tight. And so,
more competition for those dollars.
And it's I think at some point in time we have to get creative and figure out how to deal with it, because the Constitution. What does the Constitution say about an equal opportunity for education?
General and uniform system.
Thorough and efficient.
Thorough and efficient.
So as we get to communities that maybe have more opportunity and more resources, the gap gets bigger and bigger, and it's becoming.
That's where, you know, the pressure on some of the schools. You don't want to take all of it off. It kind of forces them to try to work through some and find some solutions. We can't do it all sitting around this table. We're not dealing with what the reality is out there. And, you know, they know, too, what their taxpayers are willing to do.
Because if you expect the property tax base to cover it all, that's getting more and more difficult.
Well, it doesn't work in rural Minnesota. The tax base isn't there to do it. But the people are still there.
Yes.
So are the kids. And so some way, somehow, we got to figure it out. I know in my area, the schools are all, they were built in 1920.
By the mining companies.
Well, probably by mining taxes, yeah.
Yeah.
But the fact is that while they're very nice buildings now, somewhere along the way, who knows what's going to happen here, and they may need new buildings, or your point about what's going to be like in 20 years, where we're going to be learning and how we're going to be learning, who knows? But yeah. Things have moved pretty fast over the technological range here over the years.
I'll never forget back in the days, Senator Tomasoni, when I was working for the department and traveled up. I remember Greenway Coleraine. Mm-hmm. It was in the spring, beautiful day, and I walked up the steps to that school, and I opened the door, and I thought, what am I hearing? Well, it was an organ. I mean, they had an organ. I don't know if it was a pipe organ in that school. I mean, they were practicing for graduation.
I thought you were going to say a hockey puck hitting the boards. That's what I thought.
No, it was in the spring. It was a beautiful day. And then going to Hibbing and seeing that gorgeous auditorium, mm-hmm. with I think it still has the original seats and the backdrops for that stage. There's some gorgeous things, and have had people have respected, and it's held up for a long period of time.
They were very well built. The education system was very important. In fact, in 1920, when Chisholm built the senior high school and the junior high school, one was built for $250,000 and one was built for $350,000. The Hibbing High School was built for $3.9 million at the same time. And so you see the difference. But there was also quite a few more people. But I think Senator Stump hit on something when he talked about sports. That's very important, because what's happening in these small communities is that sports is starting to bring communities together that generally would never, ever get together because there's not enough kids. I used to say that if you think the wall between the wall knocking down the Berlin Wall was difficult, you should see the wall between Hibbing and Chisholm. Well, what's started to happen is that Chisholm has gotten small enough so it's not cost-effective to continue some of the sports. In fact, hockey's one of them, and so now Chisholm is playing on the Hibbing hockey team together. It's called the Hibbing Chisholm hockey team now, and it's happening all over the rural areas. And so the sports might start driving some of the education policy. I don't know, but
well, we're losing all of our people who are trying to avoid making a decision in this subject. Senator Hahn.
I just wanted to thank Mr. Nauman for putting this information together, because it's very well laid out. Or no, actually, Senate staff, whoever put this together.
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair, because I just have to say a word for Senator Rosen, because as long as I've been here, she's been bringing this before the committee. And so while I agree with everything that's been said, and that you'd hate to do something that was going to have long-term effects of opening floodgates and all that, I still am very concerned about those kids in that school. And so if there's just some way we can think of to, and maybe it's doing a pilot, something like where, I keep talking about separating the administrative functions from teaching and learning, to say, okay, well, we'll, somehow appropriate you a pilot to just do your learning environment if you jettison your administration and let somebody else deliver that in some cooperative way. I don't have an answer, but I'm just saying I feel like those kids are owed something so that they can be in a learning environment that is inspiring.
Well, what you're also suggesting is there a way we can put a box around? We've got an open-ended thing right
exactly.
now. Do we need to kind of put a box around and deal with what is now, but let it be known that that's not the path that we're ready to go down?
Yes.
Because there were some unique things about it, not only the age of and deterioration of the one building, but also the impact of the flooding that wasn't totally recognized and appreciated in the Rushford Peterson, and unanticipated.
Yeah.
I think you're suggesting some things. I think Senator Stump too, in terms of trying to look forward. But I think we owe it to future legislatures not to necessarily punt
Right.
You know, they're going to be forced to make decisions. We're not going to make it for them all the way down the way, but we might not just, we might want to do something other than leave this open-ended opportunity here and deal with it in another way for the long-standing difficulties, particularly in the United South Central one. But the I don't know how long, the Rushford Peterson, that's just been the last couple of years.
That's since the flood, Madam Chair.
Yes, which was what year? Got a good memory, but it's short.
2009, possibly?
Okay.
Seven.
Seven.
Oh.
Yeah. Senator Stumpf.
One other part of the program that's not on here is, and I'm sure it's not on here because we were just dealing with those two school districts. But if you look at the facilities in the metropolitan area, they have a bonding option that other districts don't have. And I think that's
Are you thinking of cities of the first class? Or?
Well,
it's
alternative bonding, which is...
alternative facilities.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a,
with the size, yes.
Yeah.
I think when that was put in place, we had so many dollars and we cut it off, but it was the square footage and the age, combined age.
Correct.
And it discriminates against ones that have very old buildings but don't quite meet because they're a little smaller.
Yes.
You know, whether it's in the metro or wherever.
And I think that option might have hold some promise for other districts if we took a look at it. I think the current interest rate that the state's paying is about 2.5%. Now, granted, you know, I suppose this bonding is done through existing districts, but I think we ought not to forget that we are in a period of time when interest rates are extremely low. The short-term interest rates, the mean for the $599 million that the districts have borrowed is 0.4%. The range is from 0.1% to 1%. So, I mean, historically, I don't think we've ever seen interest rates at that low range. And maybe there's some way to work with that program too to address facilities in other parts of the state.
Madam Chair,
thank you for that because I've dealt with that, but it wasn't on my wavelength right now. So thank you for adding it, Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair and members, the reason we left it off is that it's for deferred maintenance. It's not for new buildings. So since we were talking about new buildings, we confined it to that discussion. But certainly Senator Stumpf is entirely correct in saying that the large districts have somewhat of an advantage. Now, there's also the deferred maintenance program, which was designed for all those districts that are not in alternative facilities to put them on more or less a more level playing field, but I wouldn't want to suggest they're entirely the same.
Well, I think this has been a healthy discussion. I don't know that that the ones of us who are left are ready to make a recommendation, but...
Well, we can pass it.
Probably something good. There's something other, Madam Chair. Which one is the one that the Hibbing Junior High School got that had... They had some mold, and so they qualified for a grant.
Madam Chair and members, also, Senator Tomasoni is correct. Health and safety revenue.
Health and safety. They qualified. The money would tear down the wall, but it wouldn't give them any money to put the wall back up.
Put it back up.
Right?
So
there's
Senator Nelson?
Madam Chair, before we adjourn, I just wanted to a moment of personal... A privilege.
You should have taken it before we.
They
got
all left.
Yes.
Yes. But now you're all welcome. Please, I'll walk down the steps, get on the trolley, and head to the Wellstone Center to see innovation that will knock your socks off. I'm not kidding you. Rochester's a city of innovation, and some of the things that they have brought to show you tonight are fabulous. Plus, of course, great Rochester food and music. But the innovation is phenomenal. I hope you can join us.
Thanks. So, the meeting is adjourned. Further business? Thank you all, members.
Brother who's 17. My dad has a second family, and they're twins, and they're seniors. And
well, Senator Stumpf, yeah. I think we're going to make some headway in that career.
So it's very important to them that I do.
Absolutely. I understand family things.
Yeah.
So,
hello.
Just to Eric, because of the comment you made, facility.
Did you get your guy? No, I think
what?
You're
trying
person's
to
start.
Allotment.
To catch
person's
your
allotment.
Person.
Per student
for infrastructure.
Well, that's always the case.
Right.
Okay.
But then you also put in there the sparsity aid logarithm that we have. The smaller you are, the more sparse you are, the more money you get per student.
Because you don't need as much space.
Because you got fewer people to put a building together.
Oh dear. So you can figure out who's
going
to be for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can't create a whole new pupil count, even.
You don't even know. Look at the eyes glee.
It's like, gotta go.
Or you're not looking.
To our short agenda.
Yeah. We got it done.
See you tomorrow,
Donna.
We'll have a good lunch for you.
No,
I've
kind of got the
curly. I have a plug under here.
You tell Lori that?
Beach now.
Can't get anything by this. I'm just, you know, see, people who know me, they know I'm a lady that goes from party to party as quickly as possible. Exactly. So I need to talk to you guys to see if I get a principal evaluation in our agenda. 35%.
I think it's
part of
it. We've got it on one of the.
It's coming up.
Oh, wonderful. We're going to be able to have longer blocks.
Okay.
Are they taking you for Rochester? Is this a thing?
Funds track as far as operative and non-operative, in between the non-operative.
Did you get the message that I was sending? Because that is license.
Senator Olson. Okay.
Right. Yep. The general pot.
Yeah. Well, the bargaining, I don't have an answer. See, don't have an answer.
All right, we'll see you.
But, and, the no levy part I do get, because they can't, because it's written in the law, they can't increase their taxes.
The authority, but that's a levy that's ongoing that they can make every year.
Okay,
see, it isn't like the leftover.
Pretty well.
So what you're
bond.
Telling me is, well, I...
About this.
I will. Maybe there's a way to do it for a short amount of time.
Well, we've done it
shifted.
For 2 years.
Yeah,
but
so maybe we should. Okay, I will. I'll follow up with you.
Yeah, we'll
are you coming down to innovation?
I've got a carpooling, and I've got.